Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Deep Water, a program on religion, culture, and public affairs. The theme of the program is that we as faith communities are only in our social ministries up to our ankles. We ought to be over our heads, hence the name Deep Water. Our panelists this morning are the Reverend Angela Ying of Bethany United Church of Christ on Beacon Hill in Seattle, the Reverend Dr. Robert Jeffrey, Senior Minister at New Hope Missionary Baptist Church in Seattle, and Jeff Siddiqui, a member of the Greater Puget Sound Muslim Community. My name is Don McKenzie, and I'm Minister and Head of Staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ. So the question for us is to look back over the year of 2001 and identify an event or series of events or ideas that had the most meaning for you at this point, and what's that all about? Let's start with you, Jeff.
I'm struck by the growing and the stark contrast between our government, our leadership on one hand, and our people on the other. We have a government that over time, the United States government has been becoming militarily stronger and stronger. It is undoubtedly the strongest military power in the world today. It is the equivalent of Rome. You cannot do anything without Rome's approval. And with that kind of power, the government, instead of being more aware of the less blessed countries and peoples, is approaching any of its problems with a bigger hammer. If the 5-pound hammer doesn't work, maybe the 5,000-pound hammer that they call the daisy cutter would work. On the other hand, and this is almost a night and day contrast, the people are reaching out and trying to understand the other, trying to understand different cultures, trying to understand different religions, trying to understand different ideas, even things that they had never even thought of until yesterday or until 4 months ago. So the people are opening, societies and communities within the United States are opening up like I cannot envision any other society opening up in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. How do you understand the incredible approval rating that President Bush has right now in the context of what you just said?
It is indeed baffling. But from a political point of view, unfortunately, our people respond very well to the explosions and the fireworks when we see things. That we have a gladiatorial response. We see something being attacked by lions and we go, yay. And our government, prior to September 11, George Bush was considered to be a pretty useless leader. And certainly because he started blowing things up, it's the right thing to do. It's also a part of human nature to come together in times of stress. Yeah. And if we have a kind of leadership that harnesses that coalescing of the people and says, come on, and then channels it towards a violent direction, it just multiplies. That's probably why we've got a 90% approval rating. Yeah. I suspect and I dearly hope that a few years from now people will look back at this period and say, how could we deal with ourselves and with the world in such a shameful manner? Undermine the Constitution, take away human rights. How could we do that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a matter of safety that people felt and still feel because of the heightened threat against personal security, that there's an intruder at the door and that somebody has to have a big gun out there to keep them out. And they're willing in that instance to forego any analysis as long as they hear the shots and as long as they're being told that these big guns are necessary to keep out the intruder. But I think you're right that eventually we will do the analysis and we will look intricately and introspectively at everything that's going on. And I think that a lot of people are going to have a lot of answering to do and in the near future.
I'm into that.
Do you think it's possible, Jeff, that given what you just said, that more attention will be paid to the issue of the cycle of violence and how to stop that. In other words, might we hear the words of Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi or other moral leaders who have suggested that nonviolent resistance could be a method to stop the cycle of violence and begin to start to deal with our problems in a way that is humane? Do you have a hope for that, that might actually arise from this thing that's boiling right now?
The one thing as humanity we all have in common is hope. We always hope. But you do bring up a very, very good question. Here, for decades, our governments, our leadership has been saying this cycle of violence has to stop. We say it again, we say it again, and we say to our inner city children who are growing up, no, we have to teach you to discuss your problems, not attack them with a fist. And then we don't model it. As we've seen in what's going on in Afghanistan, we didn't give peace a chance. We didn't waste time with the niceties of peaceful conversation. We went in with threats, and immediately after that, we went in with bombs. So I do have an unending reservoir of hope that we will see that it's sort of like a parent who drinks and smokes and then says to his children, don't drink and smoke. It's a bad example to set. But sometimes children grow up to be wiser than their parents. And let's hope.
May it be so. So from your point of view, it's that contrast between the actions of our government on the one hand and a sort of mounting conviction in the culture that cooperation and understanding are not only valuable, but absolutely necessary to the future of the planet.
From what I see, that's what the people are saying. Mm-hmm. We need to understand. We need to have a dialogue. I need to stand in your shoes for a while to see what it feels like to be you, the other. And so, please God that we as a people will not only do this, but will ultimately force our government to do this as well.
Good. Okay, let's go to Robert Jeffrey and see what he's thinking about, and we'll probably come back to this thing in our final conversation. Robert, what would you identify?
Well, the thing that I was really involved in last year was the Aaron Roberts shooting. A latter part of the year, but most of the year I was dealing with the issues of racial profiling in the inner cities and the attitude of the police and the attitude of the citizenry toward the police, which I think all of these dynamics are the same thing that we see in relationship to the bombing of Afghanistan. It's African-American inner-city youth are perceived as the enemy. They're perceived as people that have to be controlled. Even though they don't import drugs, they don't launder the money, they have no banks, they basically answer to people who are downtown. They're perceived to be the threat. Most of the murders have never been white on black. They've been black people killing blacks in the inner city as it relates to the drug deal, the selling. But they're perceived as the monsters. So therefore, the police are able to pretty much do with them as they will. For example, in the Aaron Roberts situation, a guy was shot and killed, allegedly having reached out, pulled the policeman's arm into the thing, at the same time driving and at the same time shifting and reverse and going backwards and then going forwards and in some ways threatening the police life. It was just a ridiculous story. And the inquest jury basically was a shutout. They found the police innocent. Obviously, that's a part of the hysteria that says that we have to believe authority when we feel threatened, regardless of whether or not the authorities are telling us the truth, regardless of whether or not the authority story makes sense, regardless of whether or not these people are bad people and therefore the authorities are doing us a favor by keeping them in check. Mm-hmm. That's a very dangerous thing that's going on in this country, and it's basically the precursor to a totalitarianist system. I don't think that people understand how close they are to some maniac coming into power and saying that the only way you're going to be protected is you give me ultimate power. I think the Attorney General approaches that, but thank God we have Congress there to some extent trying to keep him under check. But I think that we've got some serious problems with dealing analytically with our problems and trying to say that we have to solve them in the same way has been stated, that if you're going to talk about a better world, a more peaceful world, then we have to start addressing the problems in a way that it can comprehensively solve them. One of the things that's going on now is we're bombing Afghanistan, but we're not hearing what the Middle East people are saying. They're talking about the Palestinian children that are dying. They're talking about the kind of thing that's going on in Palestine. They continuously give us a sense that that you cannot, the world cannot have this South African kind of tight-like situation going on indefinitely without some response or without some reaction on the part of radicals and people who lose patience and lose hope. Those are the things that precipitate these kinds of things. We're not listening. And, you know, the way the Bush administration is handling the Palestinian situation now, I think it's akin to just I think that in some ways it's almost criminal the way they're handling it in terms of the potential problems it could have for us as American people. I think we should be more concerned with that in terms of our public safety issues than a lot of other things that we're afraid of. To just allow Sharon to treat Arafat as though he's a child and send him to his room. That is a tantamount to just total disrespect and disdain for the life of my children in America, because he's saying that he has the power to protect my children, and he can send a world leader to his room and get away with it. And for the Bush administration to sit back and do nothing about that is just appalling to me. I am just outraged about that, and I don't understand how it can, in the light of public safety, allow our leaders to totally disrespect the rights of other people and expect our public safety to be protected. And that is one of the dilemmas that we face as we move into the next year. I think that the American people need to wake up. They need to understand that the big hammer may solve some problems temporarily, but the big hammer didn't work for the Roman Empire. It didn't work for the Nazis. It didn't work for any totalitarian system, and it's not going to work for us. We've got to work through these problems systemically and analytically. And if Arafat is not a world leader, then why is he respected by most of the world? Sharon had no business doing what he did. In the same way, we have no business disrespecting the rights of others. And I think that it's a very complex situation, but it is very simple when you start looking at how we react to inner city dynamics. And the Aaron Roberts thing, I think, for me, is pivotal.
So it's a question of how we in this culture understand moral authority and what the issues are that are related to moral authority, and for example the question of white privilege. In whom do we invest the power to make decisions?
I think we invest the power to make decisions into people who have respect for givens. Mm-hmm. For example, Arafat is a given leader, just as I could not come in and question George Bush's president or something like that, and no, we wouldn't allow any country to do that to us. Mm-hmm. I think that what Sharon did was say that you are a leader because we allow you to be, not because you are legitimate, and not because you have legitimacy in relationship to your own people, and your own people give you that legitimacy, that we determine legitimacy. That is an insult to people who are now struggling for the kind of respect and legitimacy that the first world it gets automatically. And to say to the black community in the inner city that we don't trust anything you have to say about this, to say to the leadership that your analysis is wrong, even in the face of the fact that you have policemen telling five different lies, five different versions, and to then say that your credibility is only subject to our sense that you should be or will be credible, is the same kind of notion that power is right, mm-hmm. and that those who have no power, regardless of the legitimacy of their story, will not be respected. That kind of way of doing analysis is more threatening to my grandchildren than anything I've seen done. And I think that we need to understand that. And I think we need to start saying it. I think we're afraid to say it because I think that many times people who do say it are, you know, are really, you know, people who are in power come down on them. But I think that we can't allow that to happen because silence is not going to get us anywhere but more problems.
It doesn't happen very often, at least in my experience, that we are encouraged to think about the relationship between dynamics happening locally and happening globally, or at least at some distance, such as in Israel-Palestine. I think that's an important issue. Thank you. Thank you. Angela, how about you?
I think looking back in 2001, you know, especially with September 11th and all the events that, you know, others have shared, one of the biggest things to recognize is couple events I wanted to share was one, the second anniversary of N30, actually, and that was connected to the whole movement of Jubilee South and connected to what Robert and Jeff have said. Leaders from and grassroots movement people from all over the world gathered and shared about the economic injustice that's been going on in the world and continues to occur along with the racism. And the whole concept, again, of debt and how, especially in countries like Africa and in South America, how that continues to be killing the people and starving the people's children. And 2 years later, after, you know, November 30th, 1999, the people gathered here all over the world, again, to say no. And so for me, again, that's a piece of hope that's coming from the people saying we have to look from a much more global and international perspective about the concerns that are going on in the world. That September 11th allowed us again once more to look at the vulnerability and the need for community of people all across the world. And then, like you were saying, Don, you know, how does that connect locally? Well, only a couple blocks from Bethany United Church of Christ, which is a multicultural, multiracial church, which continues to grow because people are concerned. Two things happened. We had a human rights vigil where Muslims and Sikhs and Arabs and atheists and Christians and Jews gathered, you know, to say, you know, there's a lot of brokenness out there, and we need to really deeply pray and analyze how we can stop the violence. A second thing was a couple blocks from the church, we had a Somalian grocery store, which was pretty much all their foods and supplies was confiscated and literally shut down for absolutely no reason at all. And what we found out was in time, you know, they were losing their businesses, the entire family and that community was being totally effective right here in South Seattle and Rainier Valley, which has always been the most diverse community and at the same time has always struggled economically as well as with growing racial profiling and problems. And what was the hope was that people from the community, after we got the grocery store opened again, started to say, we will not, no longer will we be fearful. We'll begin to support, you know, our mom and pop stores that are in our neighborhood, and that's a part of the way that we can deal with it locally, that we need to pay attention to how people every day struggle to make ends meet. And how this particular family was supporting, you know, 13 or so family members through their grocery store. And this is right here in Seattle, in the Rainier Valley, that this is one example of the economic injustice and the economic, from a local all the way to an international perspective, that for me, you know, if you look at it from, you know, from terrorism to capitalism, you realize that economic injustice is a huge violence on humankind and the human people. And so, and one of the hopes is that, you know, with the Jubilee South movement, with the human rights movement vigil, with all the people that gathered from different backgrounds and races and faiths, and in the community from September 11th on with candles and saying no more, we will not forget this, that there is a huge economic piece that's connected, and that part of it we cannot forget because it impacts, you know, so much of the world around us in the midst of poverty and brokenness, pain and hunger and death.
Yeah. Thank you, Angela. I've been thinking about this question, too, and I was struck by the really massive success of the film O Brother, Where Art Thou, along with the success of the soundtrack CD that went with it. And I've been wondering why. And I'm bringing this to the table today because I'm wondering whether or not it's because people really are searching for ways to make moral decisions. And that's what the Odyssey was about, even though the Coen brothers who made the film confessed they had really not read the Odyssey. They do borrow quite a bit from that story, and that's what the film is about. It's about one person's attempt to find a way to make moral choices. So I wonder if there isn't something underneath all of this, all of these things that we're talking about now, these things that are really boiling and fermenting in our culture, that suggests that there is a tremendously deep desire to make the right decisions, to make them not based on the self-interest or interest even limited to those closest to us, but rather on a basis that would be for the common good, decisions that we would call moral decisions because they have good outcomes, good for the community. So I just wonder if that isn't part of the success of that film, is that it raises those issues and it makes them in some way accessible. We can connect with them. And I think the other way we connect is the music that is in that film is music that has a directness in its message that helps us to understand the importance of having hope, of living in community, of living a life that isn't so complicated that you go crazy and so forth. So it's an odd thing to bring up in a way, and certainly isn't of the magnitude of what happened on September 11th, but it seemed to me that what happened on September 11th reflects a lot of these things that we're talking about, that there was a sudden catharsis that came out of struggles that are happening at a number of different levels all over the world. And I hope that as historians look back at this time, what will be written will be that we learn something from this incredible time of upheaval about the issues that each of you has brought up, and that we learn something in terms of making moral choices that benefit the common good and so forth.
Well, connected to the film, if I remember from the very first scene, I mean, they are in stripes. And for me, that's very visual. And they're also in the field working with other people, which reminds me of working people that are chained to their own everyday, you know, struggles. And so it's almost like a prison within or prison without, you know, it's the same thing. So part of the yearning is to break from those chains, whether it's debt, whether it's racism, whether it's, you know, innocent people being killed, whether it's whatever it is. Yeah. That's one piece of it. I think another piece that we kind of would be interesting to share is that in reflecting after September 11th, it was like, well, what was it that helped us to move away from what we were sharing as colleagues earlier of so that the internment, you know, what happened after Pearl Harbor wouldn't happen to the Japanese Americans again, and or in this case wouldn't happen to our Muslim and Arab brothers and sisters. What we're finding, though, is that perhaps it's more covert, and what we need to be, again, is to analyze that more carefully so that it doesn't happen when it's connected to keeping people, again, in prisons that are not necessarily behind bars, which, again, is a whole different issue. But I didn't know if Jeff, you want, or others wanted to comment on that, but you were sharing a little bit about that earlier.
I think there seems to be a growing tendency to approach it from the ancient thought, if it doesn't hurt, it's not doing you good. And so we're going to fight crime, we're going to fight terrorism, we're going to fight all these things. And in exchange, just for a little while, you'll have to give up some of the things that you cherish so much. But it's only temporary, you understand. And they end up taking away some of our constitutional rights. And I understand and I feel, just like everyone else does, what a painful event the tragedy of September 11 was. But I would say that undermining our constitution is a greater damage to the fabric of this nation than the people who were killed in September 11. They were killed, that event happened right away, and it affected those 3,000 people, as we now know, and perhaps five times as many if you include their families and friends. But it's a finite event. If we allow our leaders to take away or undermine or take away chunks of our constitution, that is affecting 250 million people every day of our lives and pretty much forever, because the Congress is not known for its character or strength to say we will now give the rights back. Those rights are not theirs to take away. They are not theirs to return. But if we don't watch it right now, they are disappearing.
For me, the issue is terror. As an African-American person growing up in this country, my life has been filled with episodes of terror. Mm-hmm. From the time I was able to walk down the streets and I would hear people saying nigger, that little nigger boy, people bigger than me, to the, going to school and being called a nigger, being in situations of jeopardy when I see policemen. I mean, terror is the issue for me. The law in the Constitution protects American citizens from terror, from the right of unlawful search and seizures, terror in the night. The fact that we will fight terror with terror is a problem, because you cannot then say terror is the enemy, and terror is the enemy. Mm-hmm. What happened on September 11th is evil because it is about terror. The world has to move beyond the need to use terror when it can't find any other strategy, when it's frustrated, when it's up against the wall. And you can't practice terror and preach against it at the same time. Indeed. And that, to me, is the point. It is not whether or not we want to be safe. It is whether or not we will use terror to make us safe. And if we do, then we're no better than those who use terror in other ways. And my sense is that it is the terror that I want us to move from. It is the sense that people are not safe in a particular environment, especially people in this country. And I think that that is something that we cannot allow to exist on these shores in the way that people are talking cavalierly about it now. I know African Americans have existed in this environment for years. So I think we need to listen to them and hear their voices, because, you know, I believe that you cannot suspend rights. And of course, many African Americans are saying, yeah, well, it's okay, because obviously some of them have lived with it for so long, you know. But the issue for me is that terror must be overcome by reason, by action, by aggressive action, but not by terror.
I agree.
I think that's about all we have time for today. Thank you so much, everyone. And thank you for listening, those of you out in our radio audience. We'll be back again the first Sunday morning in February with another step down into deep water. In the meantime, may God bless you and keep you.